Buddhist Summer School, 1973. Evening Lecture, Sunday, 26th August, 1973.
From that day to this, he has proved himself a wonderful friend to the society, a great scholar, a fine writer, and a beloved friend. Tonight, once again, he is giving of his best to the summer school, which he loves as much as we love him to be here, and is talking on creation, transformation. The message he's brought us for many years, which I see I wrote in my notebook when he talked to us in 1969, there's not enough love in Buddhism. I expect you'll be saying something more about that tonight, later.
Mr. Chairman, Honourable Sir, ladies and gentlemen, death is the unquestioned Lord of all sense apprehension of the world. Sorrow sits in the heart at the end of every event, and confusion clouds the mind. Let us consider together, calmly and happily. Stimuli from without, and also from within, such as hunger or an ache, make impressions on the brain by way of the sense organs and the nervous system. In infancy, a succession of sense stimuli impinge upon and sometimes hold one's attention. These percepts are the immediate living experience. Those around us, speaking aloud, tell us the names of persons and objects and use words which stand for actions, qualities, and relationships. Language integrates our sense experience. Gradually, there arise concepts. Then the spoken word or sentence recalls the percepts of things and persons and actions and qualities such as pleasant or painful. Whilst the act of perceiving is the immediate living experience, the concept is a mental and verbal construct abstracted out of thousands of percepts originally dissociated from words. The words are labels for live experiences. We know, as we say, what we are perceiving by referring it to our mental card index. That is, our concepts enable us to recognize our percepts. There comes the stage when concepts, instead of serving us simply as tools for recognition, come to life, so to say, and an inner abstract intellectual process starts up, as in pure mathematics. Concepts are indispensable for structuring our percepts, or making a cohesive thought pattern, or for producing and maintaining order out of the stream of percepts in our everyday life, or for communicating with others who understand the language we use. But concepts and conceptual thinking introduce certain difficulties. First, bear in mind that all discursive thought, as the nun Dhammadinna said to the lay follower Visakha, is activity of speech. Perception and feeling is activity of mind. Now, just as most words have definite meanings, what we call clear concepts have precise meanings. Our beliefs and convictions are expressed in conceptual terms. In the light of fresh evidence, we do not find it difficult to change our concepts. We change a concept or our discursive thought procedure, an activity of speech, to accommodate it to what we feel or perceive to be true. But when such feeling, an activity of mind, becomes a fixed belief or conviction, a rigid dogma or doctrine, we are bound fast by such fixations. The conditioned mind then ceases to perform its proper function, namely, to be intelligent, which means to perceive in freedom the truth of things. Since what we call knowledge is a logically structured, integrated pattern of concepts, we see how such knowledge can be an obstruction to wisdom, which is the free functioning of intelligence in the living here now. Again, concepts inhibit percepts. The actual perceiving is the living process in the immediate moment. It is always in the present tense, sensitive, changing, active. It is your life movement. But the concept is a fixture. It is a part of your mental toolbox. It belongs to the past. Let us take an example of how it works. Suppose a man with whom I have worked for many years walks into the room. My concept of him enables me to recognize him at once. I hold out my hand and say, "Hello, Tom." But with whom am I shaking hands? With Tom? Or with a man shrouded by the cloak of my concept of him? Am I then truly perceiving the whole being, Tom? Or has my fossil of a concept intruded upon the immediate living percept and dismissed, or at least hidden, the true living Tom? Can I then give him my undivided attention? And if I cannot, can there be real relationship, real love and understanding between us? does not my concept effectively prevent the communication which could be creative and transforming? And unhappily, this is typical of what happens through the day and for all the days of our lives. If we understand this, we may begin to glimpse the significance and importance of the Buddha's discipline of the senses and the putting aside of the five hindrances before entering the Brahma Viharas, that meditative state of suffusing everyone and all the world with love. Percepts are always associated with sensations and also with feelings, whether pleasant or painful or neutral. The accumulation of pleasant feelings in connection with any specific thing or person or experience or situation generates its psychological counterpart of attachment, expressed in common parlance by "I like this," and unpleasant feelings give rise to "I dislike this" and to aversion. Thus, we have craving and malevolence operating throughout our lives. When a moral code is superimposed on this, we are subjected to the constant conflict of virtue against vice, of "I like or wish" against "but I ought not." On the rare occasions where there is spontaneous virtue, there is the absence of ought and wish and like. Attachment and aversion make us take sides with what we like against what we dislike. In this state of psychological unease, there can never be dispassionate observation. Preferential choice, and the subconscious preferential choice is far more insidious than the conscious, does not allow mindfulness to be perfect. Hence, we are always discriminatively conscious, discriminatively in the sense of being subjected to partiality caused by desire or impulse or appetite or passion. Recall the Buddha's words that the Arahant, the perfected one, cannot go astray through desire. As long as we are incapable of pure mindfulness, we cannot have clear vision of the truth. There is another, a basic difficulty, a difficulty inherent in all discriminative consciousness. All perception, all discriminative consciousness involves the separation of the seer and the seen, of the cognizer and the cognized. We are conscious in terms of you and I, of I and the world, of self and not self. That is, we are isolatively self-conscious in relation to the not self. This is the basic duality which is the root of conflict. Moreover, we are not conscious of all the interrelationships actually present between objects. We are separatively object conscious. So we are unaware in actual fact of the unitary wholeness of the total reality. We are aware of this totality only in terms of separate particulars, only as finite entities. Our discriminative consciousness, our vijnana, cannot transcend the bounds of finitude and be at ease in the non-finite. If and when such transcending is realized, vijnana is transformed into vijnanam anidasanam anantam sarvato bhavam. Invisible, infinite consciousness which shines everywhere. The teachers of the Upanishads used the simple word Atma to represent this. In this state, there is no longer present anything which may be referred to as my consciousness. There is only pure awareness. The existential being whom you see and hear is a bundle of five aggregates as presented in ordinary Buddhist analysis. Purely for convenience, let us reduce this to the twofold nama-rupa, mind-body or name-form or mentality-materiality. I, the living person, am a mind-body phenomenon or psychophysical organism, conscious in a limited manner of the total reality. Being constituted thus and functioning as I do function, I am conscious of reality and I express my limited awareness of the whole limitless reality in terms of space and time and matter and energy. As already mentioned, I am conscious of finite entities, whether regarded by me as animate or inanimate. But this whole universe is a living universe. Livingness is inseparable from ceaseless changing, whether that changing be one of coming into being, growing and maturing, or of decaying, disintegrating and disappearing into non-being. Conditioned in the manner in which I am conditioned, I call this changing birth and death. Let us inquire, what sort of a mental feel is associated with the word death? It seems to be something fixed, absolute, unchanging, immutable, unmoving, annihilating. Our vijnana seems to be turned back, seems to rebound violently on striking an impenetrable boundary of human cognition, helpless, stunned, terrified, petrified. The logical chatter by the intellect may spew out all kinds of consolatory fantasies to cover up the fact that I am not livingly conscious of and perceiving the dimension, unknown as yet, introduced by death. But I can never face life rightly if I play false with death. Contrast with this, the feel in the mind associated with the word dying, It is a field of process, proceeding, happening, changing. But good God, if it is proceeding, happening and changing, it is alive. Alive in this immeasurable instant. In this eternal now. Thrilling, ceaselessly creating, exactly like and simultaneous with being born. The coming to be of this is in fact coterminous with the ceasing to be of that. But vijnana is such a sluggard, and all fixed beliefs, all borrowed ideas, and all conditioned modes of thought or meditation are such miserable burdens blanking intelligence that it seems almost impossible ever to slip off this deadly dao dukkha which clings to my whole being and to which I cling. And how comes it that I cling to dukkha? I cling because I am ignorant. And sorrow of all sorrow, I am ignorant of the real meaning of ignorance in this transcendental context, the universal context of the one total reality. Avidya, ignorance, in this context, does not mean not knowing your reading, writing and arithmetic. All knowledge in that sense, both secular and catechistically religious, has its due place in the everyday worldly life, but can be a heavy burden which desensitizes the mind where spiritual insight is concerned. Crammed with such knowledge, I am an obstruction to the light of transcendence. Freed of the restricting and conditioning of my intelligence to see the truth of things imposed by such knowledge, the obtrusive eye, the isolated self-consciousness, is no more present. Vijnana, the sluggard, rests in perfect peace, taken up into that awareness being which is the realization by the one total reality of itself through the nama-rupa, which is me as its instrument. I remain unknowing. What is it that enables me to be wholly unresisting to transcendence and to let vijnana be taken up into pure awareness being? It is the brahmacharya, the living of the holy life. Recall the words of the Buddha, welcoming him who had genuinely responded to the preaching of the Dhamma. Come, bhikkhu, tread the Brahma path, the path of holy living, for the complete ending of all ill. It would be difficult to find sweeter words of welcome in the annals of history, or words of profounder import for the complete ending of all ill. And the Lord of compassion and wisdom taught the simplest way. Morality, mindfulness, insight. Walking in this way, there comes the cessation of all grasping. The grasping of objects, persons, achievements, dogmas and systems. The grasping at nirvana itself. Walking in this way, there comes freedom from fear, turmoil, and hate. And there comes release from delusions. What happens to Vijnana then? As mentioned earlier, in my ordinary worldly state, I am isolatively self-conscious, separatively object-conscious. I am self-centered, and my whole energy is expended in drawing all that I desire out of the world towards me. I am still at the animal level. But unlike all natural animals, I live as an animal degraded to bestiality, since I misuse my intellect to serve self. And self can be served only at the expense of others. My business as a human being is to function and live, not as a self-oriented self, but as a selfless self. As a non-egoistic being. Whilst I live as a common worldling, I am subject to the constant discordance of chronological time with psychological time. For instance, supposing a dear person is expected to arrive at a certain time. If he does not appear on the dot, I make an allowance of some minutes for the delay. If half an hour passes by, I become anxious and agitated. As more minutes pass by, I become frantic. Each minute feels like an hour. Fantasies of horrible accidents, or raging anger that he is deceitful, faithless or treacherous, all rush through my mind. He does appear, just 43 minutes late by the clock. But my psychological time in those 43 minutes had stretched into ages and almost reached breaking point. My mental state was anything but calm, and my attention was completely out of joint with the becoming process around me. To cap it all, my friend tells me that the cause of his lateness was simply a traffic jam, a not uncommon occurrence. What were some of the forces for this disharmony between psychological time and chronological time? My desire that the flow of events should take the shape I wanted, and not what actually happened. My grasping at a particular pleasure, my attitude being self-oriented, and so on. This discord is more or less my condition throughout life. I cannot grasp the infinite. I can only grasp at finite things. All finite things undergo ceaseless change. This is the factual truth about them. What I grasp at is the particular form in which I experience them pleasurably. Being deluded and stupid, I continue to grasp at that form which is now a fixation in my mind, a memory. The actual form itself has changed, And when that change has proceeded so far that I can no longer contact it or experience it through the senses, I call that change death in the rigid sense. Rigor mortis, a dead death. And it is this which causes me sorrow psychologically, and fear, and horror. Now, if I do not grasp at fixity or particularity of form, if I am free of desire, free of isolated self-consciousness, then I can be fully attentive to the actual world process exactly as it takes place in the immediacy and wholeness of the here now. In this state of pure attentiveness, there is full freedom from any sense of loss or gain. The mind is in dynamic poise, upekkha, as the Buddha called it. What was my vijnana is now in rhythm with the universal vijnana, wholly subsumed within, entirely transparent to, and never resisting, pure awareness. The awareness which may be called pure being, transcendence, all mind, the one reality, or any such word or phrase that evokes an answering note from you. And now, psychological time, that dimension of time which is my offspring and my responsibility, which is the container of my anxiety and fear and sorrow, generated by my ignorance and incapacity, and which I inject into and thereby infect the becoming process. This psychological time is transformed into a silent stream of pure mindfulness in perfect assonance with chronological time. Chronological time will continue to bring, always, an alternation of pain and pleasure. But I shall have ceased to be a producer and maintainer of dukkha. This, and not a running away, is the meaning of the escape from dukkha. All mind, the one reality, pure awareness, is energy, primordial, creative. Creative energy, creative action, creation are all one and the same. Creative action is action in eternity. Being and consciousness are an identity. The one total reality is spirit, matter, mind, body, everything. It is the one which is the many constituting the one. Discriminative consciousness, vijnana, is the differentiator of the one. Acting as differentiator of the one and between the many and forgetting, that is, losing awareness of the unitary wholeness of the total reality, is the so-called fall of man, the descent of spirit into matter, the plunge by the bodhisattva into the womb of the lady Mahamaya, and her name means the great illusion, and hence the descent into material incarnation. But had there been no descent, no fall, there would have been no Buddha, no Christ. D1 is pure awareness. Vijnana sees and can only see the many, even if the many consists of not more than two. For Vijnana is the seeing subject or self, who sees or is conscious of at least one other, namely the seeing object or not self. Vijnana, when free of isolative self-consciousness, is identical with pure awareness. Herein there is no grasping, material or sensuous or cognitive. The full realization of non-grasping is accomplished when every vestige of self-association with rupa or vedana or samya or sankhara or vijnana has dissolved, has gone to its stopping or ending, its nirodha. Thereupon, there is the utterly unobstructed functioning of creative energy, of action in eternity, through you, the living existent, as the wholly transparent and entirely unresisting focus. You are wholly transparent because you are void of selfness, void of everything appertaining to a separate entity self. This action in eternity, this free functioning of creative energy, which means spaceless, timeless creation, is a pulsation of life, other life. This action is the supreme meaning of the word karma in its ontological sense. It is karma in its transcendent reality. Remember that its root, kri, means to do, to make, to create. Karma in its transcendent reality is acausal. There is no such thing as causality or the succession of cause and effect in this spaceless, timeless creativity. This pulse of action in eternity is ever new. It is not a disruption of the old and a reusing of the old reduced to its primordiality to produce or put together the new. Such is the awesome, majestic marvel and wonder of creation. And the new is a transmutation. Vijnana sees this transmutation as transformation. Vijnana cognizes a space-time energetic universe. Hence, I, as the living existent, whilst I am confined within the ring past not of Vijnana, see the becoming process, samsara, as birth and death, discrete and particular, and as a continuity in time and space of what I call causally connected events. The confinement to discriminative consciousness means confinement to mortality. Hence it was said at the beginning of this talk that death is the unquestioned lord of all sense apprehension of the world. That sorrow sits in the heart at the end of every event, and confusion clouds the mind. Karma in its transcendent reality is the life, other life pulsation. It is realized in pure awareness as non-repetitive creation. We, confined to discriminative consciousness and mortality, are repetitively procreative. Our procreative activities, biologically and culturally in art, science and philosophy, keep us bound to the sphere over which death exercises overlordship. And death will continue to be overlord as long as there is any trace of selfness, of vested interest, of grasping, of attachment or aversion. But if these are rendered void, if there is real purity, wisdom and compassion, then these self-same procreative activities are all transformed by the fire of supreme sacrifice into that transcendent action which is true creation, which is the a-causal, free, unbinding and unbound, immortal karma. But for this, the purification of the mind is an indispensable preparation of the soil in which the seed of life may germinate and grow. Be free of all those distorted, petty misconceptions of karma and its so-called corollary rebirth, which are produced by our impure, confused, conditioned, frightened, perpetually self-seeking, cruel and slavish minds. Never forget that the truth makes us free. And that truth is never known until there is liberation out of discriminative consciousness. It is realized in pure awareness, for then the truth and you are one. Then you will see that death is not destruction, but other life. Life is the reality. Life is truth. Life is love and light. Birth and death are the misdirecting signposts set up in my ignorance, blinding me to the shining way of life. When I see, truly see, that death is other life, I know that in that other life there is no me repeated again. And I see that death, which is the other face of life, life's immortal and inseparable twin, offers the hospitality of life, stark, non-finite, incomprehensible, the silent containment by the absolute in the unknown and unknowable eternity. Does this sound too austere? Then remember that for us who live as mortals, as separate little individuals, there is only the way of love and understanding. Heart speaks to heart noiselessly. Who loves, hears. Who listens, understands. And so your tears can be wiped away, ere they roll down. To see and know and bear the inconsolability of death, even as the Buddha did, is to be made deathless by life and realize its benediction. Have we considered together, calmly and happily? If we have, the bliss of creation transformation is here.